Welcome to the 13th episode in the 5th season of Justice with John Carpe, a podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with me today is Ontario lawyer James Manson. James is going to talk about some recent events that have the potential to develop into active cases at the Justice Center. The two that we're going to focus on are pretty close to being that at this point, so this is a bit of a coming attractions. One situation involves two teachers who have lost their jobs due to their standing up for their religious beliefs. There's been scant coverage in the news of that story so far. The first one we'll discuss has received a lot of attention. This is the situation in Nova Scotia where the ruling party has brought in legislation allowing the government full access to all private health information. This is setting off alarm bells, and I'll let James outline the concerns. But I gotta say, as I look at this, I can't help but wonder if this is some kind of step towards a dreaded social credit system, where your whole life resides in an electronic database that can be used by government entities to limit your constitutional rights. James, is this a harbinger of worse things to come, like, say, a social credit score?
I don't think so, Kevin. I'm not sure we're at that point yet. I guess it's possible that the legislation, this new legislation in Nova Scotia, might take us down a path that might lead there. I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future, if ever. I think it would be a very, very significant development in our country for us to develop social credit scores or things of that nature. The problem, though, Kevin, of course, is that the way that this legislation has been, worded in the Nova Scotia bill that put this before the legislature, the way the wording is very vague and broad. Again, just to let the viewers and listeners know what we're talking about here. Again, we've got a situation where in the middle of the budget legislation process for Nova Scotia for this year, they shoehorned in basically a one section, part of the legislation, which is supposed to be about the budget. It's supposed to be about, money going here and money going there and all that. And in the middle of it all, there's this one section to amend the Personal Health Information Act in Nova Scotia, which is basically the medical privacy legislation in Nova Scotia. And what the section does is it adds a little bit to the ability of the governor in council, when that means the cabinet in Nova Scotia, which is basically the executive, the premier and his ministers. They can make regulations which don't need to be passed by the legislature. They can just be added at any time. And the regulations in this particular case enable the minister, I guess it's the Minister of Health, to require basically doctors in Nova Scotia to provide and disclose medical records, personal health care records, and information to the minister. Why? We're not entirely sure. Let me read you actually the entirety of this new section in the Act, and the listeners can understand that we don't know what it means. It says here that one of the ways that you can make regulations is as follows, blah, blah, blah. And this is the new section. Requiring custodians, and that would mean doctors, to disclose personal health information to the minister for the purposes of planning and management of the health system, resource allocation, and creating or maintaining electronic health record programs and services. So once again, planning and managing the healthcare system. Okay, that's extraordinarily broad. Planning and managing the healthcare system is literally everything without limitation. The next one is resource allocation to figure out, for example, where to spend money, what services go to what parts of the province, maybe in Nova Scotia, or do they open a new emergency room somewhere else or whatever. Okay, fair enough. And thirdly, creating or maintaining electronic health record programs and services. Well, that may work as well for patients who want to, say, for example, access their own medical records and their own healthcare information. I mean, it would make sense if you want to have an app, say, on your smartphone where you can enter in your personal code or whatever, and then you get all your information yourself pertaining to your own health on the phone. I can see how that might be useful to some people. The problem, though, Kevin, is that this section is extraordinarily overbroad for the purposes that it's trying to achieve. Now, you're talking about social credit scores. I don't see in that legislation that it's actually intended to bring about a social credit system. However, I also don't see that it's not possible.
Okay.
And that's the problem. So you and I are maybe on the same page with respect to being curious about this, for sure. I don't see in this section where it couldn't happen. And my view of this is one of very, very, very serious concern. We have a situation also, and I just wanted to make sure the listeners understand this. The government was lobbied, you know, so basically the College of Physicians and Surgeons was given a chance in Nova Scotia. They were given a chance to, you know, make submissions about this proposed new section. And they said, well, wait a second, this is of concern because we're talking about giving the minister access to anybody's personal health information. That's too broad. They actually made that point in a committee somewhere. And they suggested that we should aggregate all the information or make it anonymous, right? Just make it about statistics. So for example, if you're trying to figure out where to allocate your resources in the healthcare system, you don't care whether Kevin Steele or James Manson had an appendix operation. What you care about is how many people have had appendicitis in Nova Scotia and where were they, and, you know, anonymously anyway, what parts of the province were they, and what were the wait times and all these things. So that information may be useful. And the problem, of course, is that the college made that submission. The government did not accept it. The government declined to anonymize the information or to only accept statistical information, things like that. For some reason, they decided that they want the ability to have James Manson's healthcare information or Kevin Steele's or whoever. And I don't know why that would be. And they haven't really said why that would be. And the College of Physicians and Surgeons hasn't done anything else. There hasn't been a pushback that I can discern anyway, Kevin, in Nova Scotia. So, I mean, there was debate in the legislature. I understand that the opposition parties in the legislature did raise objections and these types of things. But of course, if they're overruled at the end of the day by the vote, and remembering, Kevin, as well, this is a budget vote at the end of the day. This was the budget, you know, process for Nova Scotia. So the budget can't not pass, right? And this is one of the things that the political process is disappointing about, is that when this budget bill comes, and it happens everywhere, it happens in Ontario, it happens all across the country, all around the world, is that people will attach amendments and things to budget bills, and they know that it's not going to be held up because the budget has to pass, because they have to spend money and they have to do things. And so these types of things may not fall down because of the necessity of the budget process. And that disappoints me, because obviously something important like this, where you're talking about amending the Health Privacy Act for Nova Scotia, is very important. And it deserves to be properly debated, properly vetted, and properly done. It doesn't appear to me that there was enough effort and energy put into this on behalf of all of the government of Nova Scotia. I don't know why we still don't know why this is happening. Again, in response to some concerns, the government spokespeople, ministers and stuff, they have said, look, we're not interested in James Manson's personal healthcare information. We're only interested in the top level data. But that's not what the bill says. And why didn't they accept anonymized aggregate statistical information only? Why do they have the ability to do this? And constitutionally speaking, Kevin, that is called overbroad legislation. There is a principle in our system called overbreadth. And it is one of the ways that you can use to help your argument in order to strike down legislation. You can say that the goal of the legislature may be valid. You know, again, allocating resources, that's a valid goal. Putting an electronic healthcare database together, that's not a bad idea. However, the legislation can't go farther than is necessary to achieve that goal. And if it ends up trenching on your rights, in this case, of course, we're talking about Section 8 of the Charter, which provides for protection against illegal, unconstitutional searches and seizures. Searching and seizing of your data would definitely fall under Section 8 of the Charter. And unless the government can justify the reasons for doing so under Section 1, it's unconstitutional. So it remains to be seen, Kevin, why the government needs this, why they believe they do. In my opinion, they haven't really said why they need it yet. They have said why they don't need it. They've said, well, we only want the top level data. We only want the big numbers. Well, why are you looking for the small numbers? Why are you giving yourself the power to get those small numbers? And again, you know, Kevin, this is one of these examples where we lose our rights as Western democracies a teaspoon at a time. We just lose them a little bit by little bit. And before you know it, we may well be into a social credit system. It's not about what this premier of Nova Scotia may do or this minister of health may do. It's what the minister of health may do 50 years from now or 75 years from now. I mean, imagine what happens during the next quote unquote pandemic, where now all of a sudden the minister is requiring everybody to show whether they've done this or that medical treatment in order to do this or that, right? We can remember all of the horrible things that happened 2-3 years ago. And I mean, it's obviously speculative to imagine what this might open the door to, but I don't trust that it wouldn't be abused. And so I'm concerned about that. And so I can tell you and the listeners, Kevin, that we are looking right now at avenues to challenge this section, constitutionally speaking. We're looking around for a suitable group of people, perhaps doctors. I know there's a group of doctors out in Nova Scotia who are very concerned about this because, of course, they're the ones, right, who are affected by this just as much as the patients. They're the ones who are protecting this information right now. They've got the information. They're being told to give it up. And so that's concerning to them. And so there may be a group of doctors that may want to put themselves forward as plaintiffs. Perhaps there's some patients as well in Nova Scotia who are affected by this. I mean, arguably, Kevin, everybody in Nova Scotia is theoretically directly affected by this very sweeping and overbroad legislation. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question, Kevin. I don't think we're into social credit scores, at least for now. Could it happen? I guess it could happen. Do I think it will happen? Even I don't think it's going to happen. I'm pretty concerned about where we're heading as a country. I don't think we're in that zone, but it's not to say that we couldn't be. And that's why we're doing what we're doing.
Understood. Yeah. Okay. Well, of course, when I went social credit scores, I went right to the end really fast. Here's the worst thing I could think of right away.
Right.
And
well, Kevin, you're a good lawyer that way because lawyers often think in worst case scenario terms. And so I applaud you for that.
Well, I understand, and I'm also, you know, here to be that guy, you know, the paranoid every guy, you know, so that's fine. That's part of the role I'm playing here. But I also want to hear your speculation on short-term harms. I understand the red flag, okay? The red flag is they said they need it for this purpose, but they're going overbroad by saying they need to know everybody's name. And what kind of damage can that do in the short term then? Do you have any ideas? I mean, you're talking about 75 years down the road, pandemic, potentially. Those are good examples. Is there any sort of less than pandemic harms that you see?
Well, of course there are. I mean, the short term isn't really any different than the long term. I mean, with this legislation, with this new power, the government of Nova Scotia can literally turn to any doctor at any point and say, I want to know, you know, Mary Smith. I want to know what Mary Smith's health records are. Send them over. You have to send them over. And there's nothing that a doctor could do, apparently, to stop it. So now everybody knows that Mary Smith has had a miscarriage, or she's had an abortion, or whatever reason, whatever healthcare concerns Mary may be having, they just have access to it. And so that to me is a very immediate problem. I mean, the healthcare privacy legislation is designed to protect medical privacy information, not to get rid of it, not to disclose it. Certainly there are competing interests. The government should have access to some information for valid purposes. And I would say, again, we're talking about the anonymous stuff, the stuff that leads to statistical information, the big numbers. Because again, I mean, we understand as a society, we have made it a universal healthcare country. So therefore, the government needs to know some stuff about what's going on in order to properly manage the system. That I think every reasonable Canadian would understand. If you're going to participate in the system, you're going to have to, I don't know, for example, register for a health card. If you want to get a health card, you got to provide your address and provide your date of birth and things like that. So some of the stuff is okay. It's a valid trade-off. But when you actually start talking about your actual medical treatments that you've taken or not taken, remembering a couple of years ago, Kevin, when it was a serious issue as to whether you did or didn't take a very, very well-known medical treatment. I think we all know what I'm talking about. And that divided the country in half. So that type of information is private, as far as I'm concerned. And the government really has no interest in it unless it can show that it does. And again, that's the wording of Section 1. Section 1 says that the rights in the charter can be limited reasonably if it can be justified in a free and democratic society. That's to paraphrase what it says. So if the government can explain what on earth it needs this information for, why it needs Mary Smith's personal medical file, then maybe it will justify it. But the problem I always get, Kevin, the problem I circle back to, is that we are not, and unfortunately, with all possible respect to our members on the bench, nobody is requiring the government these days to justify itself. We're not asking the government anymore to say why. You know, all through COVID, it was very, very few and far between where anybody ever asked the government to explain what it was doing and why and justify it with evidence. It was taking the benefit of the doubt. It was basically taking things on judicial notice a lot of the time, some of the courts. And in my view, anyway, I know I'm not a judge, and so that's all true. But Section 1 exists for a reason, and it's not a bad reason. Sometimes you do have to choose between competing interests, but the government has to justify it. And so once again, you're asking about short-term, you know, things. It's hard to speculate, but certainly in the short term, the government's going to have to start testing what it can and can't do here. And that will probably lead to some fights with respect to, you know, can you go that far? Can you go this far? But at the moment, the legislation is very, very broad and very, very clear. It just says personal health care information, personal health information, can just disclose any of it, all of it. And so, again, that's overbroad in my opinion. And the government hasn't explained and justified with evidence why it needs that power.
Just on that overbroad idea, is that the challenge to Section 1? In other words, when they try to justify it, you say at that point it's overbroad, or Is it in the defense of a particular right?
Yeah. It's a part of Section 1. Okay. There's also another section. Section 7 deals with overbreadth as well. Section 7 is the section that deals with life, liberty, and security of the person. You might come up with an argument that this violates Section 7 under security of the person grounds, maybe. Section 7 is a fairly hard section to get an argument through. So I don't want to waste too much time on that today. But overbreadth also comes into the overarching proportionality analysis in the Oaks test, as we call it, the Oaks test being the test that court has developed to give life and meaning to Section 1. So what does it mean to justify a limitation of a right in a free and democratic society? What does that mean? The Supreme Court has explained what that means in a case starting back in the 80s called R.V. Oaks. Mr. Oaks was an accused criminal person in a criminal situation. And he challenged some kind of a statute. And the Supreme Court in that case explained what it means for the government to pass Section 1. And there's a test you follow, and I don't need to get into the details of it, but basically that is where the overbreadth argument comes in. It's where all these types of arguments come in.
Okay, and looking at the way the legislation is written, and I don't have it in front of me, but I know you do, you say the guardrails are off here or something like that. Is there anything in there that would prevent a provincial government like Nova Scotia from, say, signing a information sharing agreement with the federal government and passing that information on? Is that a possibility?
In this case, let's look at this is the black letter law requiring, again, custodians, which is like a doctor, to disclose personal health information to the minister for the purposes of planning and managing the health system, resource allocation, and creating or maintaining an electronic health record program. So planning and managing the health system, you might say, arguably includes talking to the federal government, because the federal government is what gives us the transfer payments that we need to administer the healthcare system anyway. Resource allocation normally would mean resource allocation to different towns and hospitals in Nova Scotia. But what if it meant from the federal government to the provincial government? Resource allocation. Resource allocation is a very broad and nebulous concept. So to answer your question, Kevin, I don't know. That's a fairly terrifying point you're making. I have no idea what it means. And that's the problem, is that, you know, you're a smart guy, I'm a smart guy, and together we don't know what this means. And so, like, if we don't know what this means, who does? And that's the problem. So you've hit the nail on the head there, Kevin. I don't know whether it means that the provincial government of Nova Scotia can enter into an agreement with the feds. It might. Maybe there are other sections of the Nova Scotia Personal Health Information Act that would prevent that. But I can't say for sure right now what's going to happen. And that's the problem. And that's the immediate short-term problem that you're asking about, is that we don't know. This opens up an entire Pandora's box of possibility that the legislature, and again, look, it's very, very possible, Kevin, that nothing happens in the next 2 years, right? It's possible that the Conservative government in Nova Scotia, I believe they're Conservative right now, it's possible that they do nothing, that they don't get around to it, that they don't create an electronic healthcare system, that there's no money for it, or whatever, that they don't do it. Okay, but what about the next incoming government that comes after this one, or the next one, or the next one? We just don't know how they will interpret this new section. And again, the other thing as well, right, is once a program gets going, it's hard to stop it. So if this government in Nova Scotia creates an electronic healthcare database or something, the next government probably won't get rid of it. I mean, remember the long gun registry back years ago? Remember how hard it was to get rid of and deal with? Like, all of this would happen again. And all the millions of dollars spent on, you know, creating the darn thing would be seen to be a waste of money if you got rid of it. So once these things kind of start getting set, they get set in stone pretty quick, and it's hard to get rid of them. So it's just a real concern. And again, once again, I don't want to harp on it too much, but again, we just don't know what they're really driving at. They've said a little bit about what they claim to be driving at, but the wording of the amendment doesn't bear that out. It bears out something much more serious.
Okay. So we have no timeline on the challenge yet because we're looking for a good client to take it to court. Okay, great.
Yeah, I would hope, Kevin, that within the next few weeks or so, we'll be able to get our ducks in a row and get going. As of right now, we are in the preliminary stages of figuring out how to effectively challenge this.
Okay. I just want to conclude with, you know, when I talked about the social credit score, that's not the worst thing I could think of, actually. Because, you know, when I asked about the federal government, what I was thinking of, the worst thing I can think of is, you know, suddenly the creation of a list of people we want to target with our shiny new pamphlets about the medically assisted dying stuff. You know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that worries me the most is, you know, all of a sudden you've got a government with a list that can be culled and people convinced of, you know, things they might not otherwise be convinced of. And that's the kind of thing that really freaks me out, I guess, you know. And again, I am.
So Kevin, what you're saying. So I think, Kevin, just for the benefit of the listeners, what you're suggesting, Kevin, is that the government can then go to all the physicians in Nova Scotia and it can say, I want to know who has Lou Gehrig's disease. I want to know their personal information. And then they will send out a mail blast to all these people who have Lou Gehrig's disease. And they say, have you considered MAID?
That's exactly what I was thinking. That's to me is worse than a social credit score.
Well, that's a disgusting and valid point that I hadn't thought about that, Kevin. And now I am thinking about it. And that's terrible. So, No, fair enough. But I guess what the listeners need to understand is that it's not out of bounds. That is not inconsistent with the wording of this amendment. It doesn't say for sure that they will do that. And I would be surprised if they did, but it's not impossible.
Okay.
And again, if it's not for this government, then some government down the line. Right. And so, well, we're going to see what's what with this legislation, but, you know, keep you updated on that for sure.
Good. Okay. Thanks. I guess we can move on to our second topic here, and that is new business. Also something that is coming down the line here, and that is a new case, a couple of people that I don't know how much you can say on this yet, but this is about the Alexanders.
Right. Yeah. So I think the listeners may be aware of a young man named Josh Alexander, and he was on Twitter, and he was maybe in the news a few months back, and he was taking a position on, I believe it was the gender file, the gender issues that are going on right now. And I believe Josh, young Josh Alexander is a strict Catholic. He's a Catholic adherent, and he was, I believe, taking the position that there are only two sexes and two genders, and it's male and female, and that's the end of it. And I believe for that, he was suspended or expelled from his Catholic school. He was going to a Catholic school, and I think he got in trouble with the Catholic school. Our organization, Kevin, does not act for Josh, and so I won't say more about that case. I don't know really what's going on with him. But he has, of course, two parents, and they have gotten themselves into some trouble as well. And we at the Justice Center, we are very interested in seeing what can be done to help Matt and Nicole Alexander. These are two people who have been terminated from their employment. They are themselves very religious. They're not Catholic. They are evangelical Christian, as I understand it. So they read and they study the Bible. And my understanding is that they take a lot of their wisdom and their guidance from the scriptures, from the Bible. And so they have views about the transgender issue that's going on right now in society. And I think it's important to understand as well that they are not trying to force those views on anybody. It is not something where they're going around with billboards and signs and pamphlets and things like that, trying to convince people that any lifestyle choice is wrong or anything like that, or it's not, you know, I mean, one might imagine people saying such and such is an abomination, such and such is against God, all of these things. That is what I understand not to be the case. These people are simply trying to live their lives as they want to, which I think is a reasonable way of trying to get through life, to do it the way you want to do it, as long as you're not hurting anybody overtly. You know, this is something that should be accepted and protected. And indeed, Kevin, we have a human rights code in Ontario and everywhere. There's, I think each province has one, where these types of minority positions and things like that are protected. So you cannot discriminate in Ontario against people on the basis of many things, including their religion or their creed, as we say. In Ontario, the word is creed, basically means religion. So what happened was Nicole and Matt Alexander were, again, they're two teachers in the public school system here in Ontario. And I don't want to get too far into the facts. I do understand that in Nicole's case, she came to school one day to find a transgender flag, a pride flag, on her door, on her classroom door. And this is not something that she felt comfortable having on her door. And so I don't know why it was put on the door. I don't think there was any provoking going on, or I don't think there was anything nefarious or anything like that intended. Nobody was trying to target her or anything like that, as far as I understand it. But anyway, she took the flag off the door and put it away. My understanding is that that is what got her fired. Basically, she was called into a meeting with the principal or whoever, and basically she was grilled for a while, and then she was basically fired. I don't know if there are any other allegations against her, any more serious allegations from people who may have felt victimized or anything. My understanding is that there are none, but that's to be determined, you know, with the fullness of time. But anyway, that got her fired. Apparently, she asked to be accommodated under the Human Rights Code, because again, she's entitled to that accommodation, and she was denied. I'm not sure of the reasons, but I'm not sure there were reasons. But anyway, she was denied. Mr. Alexander, I believe his name is Matt, he was also terminated for similar reasons, and basically, he was also not accommodated. He asked for accommodation as well. I think that Matt may have been taking to Twitter or social media. He may have been putting out some biblical verses that he was in support of, which again, he has every right to do as a citizen. You have every right of freedom of expression, and the Bible is not hate speech. So you would think that he has the right to do that. In any event, one thing led to another, and he also was terminated. So that is a tragedy, of course. You know, neither Matt nor Nicole were openly condemning or criticizing anything, any students, any lifestyle choices, transsexuality, homosexuality, bisexuality, anything. Nobody was talking about any of it. They just wanted to live their lives as they consider to be appropriate. And again, I think that that's a reasonable position for any Canadian to take and to be allowed to do. So without taking any position on whether or not transgender people are students, that's a very, very complicated social issue at the moment. Obviously, Kevin, it's not what this case really is about to me. This case is about discrimination against the Alexanders for their religious beliefs. The listeners may be interested to know, I myself am not particularly religious. It's not really where I'm coming from, but I certainly support and I'm interested in protecting the rights of others who are religious to practice their faith the way they want to in this country. I think that's an essential cornerstone of our society, right? So anyway, what happened next was, you know, teachers out there listening may say, well, what about the union? So it's true, Matt and Nicole are part of a union, a teachers union, of course, right? And so it's there to protect Matt and Nicole and to, you know, advocate for them in the grievance process. So those of you who don't know what a union is, of course, a union is a group of employees that get together and they basically negotiate special, you know, bargaining powers for themselves and special employment privileges for themselves. And legislation, provincial legislation that is probably in every province, exists to facilitate all that. And one of the things that happens is you lose your right to sue the employer if they fire you. You have the right instead to launch a grievance, which the union is supposed to take up on your behalf, and they're supposed to intercede with the management on your behalf and, you know, basically sort everything out, basically, you know, get you your job back. Or if you have some beef with the management, you know, that is less than getting terminated, you can take it up with the union, who takes it up with management on your behalf, and then things get sorted out. Naturally, when things aren't sorted out and enough people are, you know, affected, that's when strikes and lockouts happen. And ultimately they get themselves worked out because ultimately the strike can't go forever, right? So that's essentially, you know, what happens. But in this case, it's not really happening very well. It is happening to a degree, but it's not happening very well. And what I mean by that is Matt and Nicole have a valid grievance against the management, against the school board. That grievance is not being advanced very quickly. They are the union, my understanding of the situation is that the union is not very, very, what's the word? They're not, shall we say, very, very strongly on Matt and Nicole's side here. They're not interested really in the human rights dimension of this, the Ontario Human Rights Code dimension where we're going to argue that there was discrimination. This is not something that the union lawyers apparently are prepared to advance on their behalf. And so my understanding is that this is kind of a reluctant participation on behalf of the union. Of course, my question is why? Why is that the case? You know, why is a union whose sole purpose is to advance and protect its employees, why are they not interested in discrimination that's happening against their employees? This is very clear discrimination. However, we're talking about the transgender issue that's happening in our society right now. And that's a very tricky issue. And it appears to me to be that the union may be more amenable to that side of the debate than the Alexanders' side of the debate. And so the question then becomes, is that appropriate? And it gets into very murky territory, Kevin, because, you know, a union doesn't have to take every position that the employee wants it to take. Some positions that the employee raises may be invalid, may be irrelevant, may not be very serious, you know, and so unions have very broad discretion in the province of Ontario, I mean, everywhere, to decline to file a grievance on behalf of an employee if they think that it's not a good one, or really there's very broad jurisdiction. The courts are not inclined to really get involved unless there's something very, very serious going on. But usually a union can kind of decide for itself what it wants to advance and what it doesn't want to advance before an arbitrator. And by the way, just so the listeners understand, the grievance process, if it can't get resolved, you know, informally, can proceed to arbitration. There's something called a labor arbitrator, and that's appointed by the government. And these people are not judges, but they are smart, legally trained people. I believe it's legally trained. They are very well-versed in labor law and employee-employer relationships, things like that. And they have basically all the powers of a court to receive evidence, consider evidence, make findings of fact, consider the law, consider the Charter of Rights, consider the Human Rights Code, all these things. Labor arbitrators are very, very powerful in the system, to the point where courts generally don't have any role to play in the arbitration. You can appeal an arbitral decision under certain circumstances, I think, but it's not that you just go to court immediately, right? What we might be able to do is help the Alexanders with a human rights angle to this. Because again, as I say, the lawyers for the union, from what I understand so far, have expressed an unwillingness to proceed to argue the human rights angle of this. So they're not going to be suggesting to anybody, if it's a mediation or a labor arbitrator, if it goes to arbitration, they won't be arguing before that person that the Alexander's rights have been discriminated against. They won't be making that argument. Why? I have no idea, because that is, to me, the most important part of it. But they don't want to do it. And I mean, the cynic might say they're just captured by the trans issues these days and they don't want to, you know, run the risk of getting ostracized or canceled in public culture or whatever. I don't know whether that's happening or not. All I know is that that's what I've heard, is that the union's not going to be doing the human rights angle of this. And so there's an opening for us to help the Alexanders by filing a human rights complaint against, I guess in this case, it would be the school board, for firing, for terminating and discriminating against the Alexanders in the process. And so that might be something that we can do for the Alexanders. There's also another angle here, Kevin. It's a lot of information here, and I'm sorry about that to the listeners, but the other part of the piece is the policy from the school board. The school board apparently has released a policy, or they've created a policy that I guess passed the school board at a meeting at some point. And the school board policy, and again, I haven't read the policy, so I don't want to comment too much about it, but what I understand is that the policy requires teachers to sort of openly celebrate and accept, or what's the word, affirm transgender people and the transgender issue. Again, this is not about whether that's true or not true. This is not about whether transgender people are worthy of respect and compassion and love and support and all of that. Nobody who is reasonable would disagree that that is true, that transgender people, true transgender people, are worthy of all of our respect and all of our support as other citizens. That's not the issue. The issue is making a policy that requires teachers to say something or do something, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be about transgenderism. It could be about, I don't know, my favorite color, to be kind of silly. You could say that there's a policy that requires me to say that my favorite color is red. My favorite color is not red. My favorite color happens to be blue. So it would be forcing me to say something that I don't want to say if that policy stands. The policy says James, Mr. Teacher James, needs to say every morning before he goes to school that his favorite color is red. Well, it's not. And even if it was, why do I have to say it every day? I don't want to say it every day. What if I want to keep it a secret? I don't know. It's a silly example. But my point is that there is something in this country, or in the Constitution, called compelled speech. And that is as important a concept as not being able to say what you want to say. Being forced to say something is just as bad as being forced not to say something. And all of it is protected by Section 2B of the Charter. So for there to be a policy that requires Matt and Nicole Alexander to say or do anything, to me, is a problem. Again, leaving aside whether it's a good idea, bad idea, whether it's socially important, whether it's a really good, I mean, again, it would fall to the government to justify that that was required and you know, reasonable in a free and democratic society. Again, what I was mentioning half an hour ago, we haven't been requiring the government to do that these days. So if the government could produce some evidence to justify why it's necessary for this policy to exist, then we could have a debate about that. But there hasn't been one. It just, the policy just exists. And Kevin, this is, again, just so the listeners understand, you know, months ago, somebody was asking me in a different interview, how is this all happening? You know, how are all these things happening? How is it that we're always, that such a small minority of people seems to be gaining such power these days with respect to their issues, their issue agendas? It's through the school board policies, for example. It's through these little things that pass a school board committee or a town council somewhere or whatever, some individual person with no oversight just produces a policy or some kind of a document or something. And all of a sudden there's this policy in place where, again, apparently the teachers in that school district have to openly celebrate transgenderism, whether they like it or not. This isn't a policy priority for the provincial government. The Minister of Education didn't say that that has to be the case. It wasn't something that Doug Ford ran on during his election campaign. It just happened to get in here through a school board that had a meeting one night, or a series of nights. I guess they'd have to prepare a policy, debate it, and pass it. But anyway, that's what happened. So if anybody ever thinks that it's not important to get into government, even at the lower levels, even at the school board levels, that is where the decisions happen that affect our communities. So, you know, if people are concerned about what's going on in the school boards, naturally, my advice would be to run for school trustee and be at those meetings and vote the way you think you should vote. But right now, we've got a lot of people on those school boards who are voting the way they think they should vote. And this is the result. So we've got these policies which require, again, teachers to do things or say things that they may not want to do. And again, Kevin, most people in Canada are reasonable people, polite people, and it's putting them in a hard position because nobody wants to be rude or mean to anybody and nobody wants to harm anybody. I really believe that. I really believe that most Canadians don't want to take away from any other Canadians unnecessarily. But they also don't want to be forced to believe something that they don't believe or say something they don't want to say. So the problem is we're too nice and we don't ultimately say the things that we think. And then what happens is these policies continue on and then they get set in stone and then here we are. So anyway, I've been going for a few minutes about this, but basically what I'm trying to say is this policy that exists could also be reviewed in court. There is also a chance that we may try to get the policy judicially reviewed in the Ontario court system. And again, I've been on the program before. We've talked about judicial reviews. It's a process kind of like an appeal. You basically ask the court to look at this policy and decide whether or not it's reasonable. And one of the major arguments would be you're forcing people to say and do things that they may not want to do. And that's not reasonable. So that is something we could also do to help the Alexanders. And just for purposes of clarity, the Alexanders are not our clients at the moment. We have made contact and we'll see where that goes. But we are very interested in this issue. I think that there's a lot of unfairness that's happened And you see, that's the insidious thing too, Kevin, right? Is that the unfairness that I'm talking about may well be in the name of fairness or of compassion or a true desire to help people. And that's, I think, the part that really baffles a lot of people on this transgender stuff, is that a lot of people, I think, are really acting out of compassion. I mean, we saw that CAST report that came out of the UK the other day, and the independent reporter, I think, she really tore the whole system apart, I think. I don't think she thought, though, that it was out of malice that all these trans-affirming care programs were happening. I think a lot of them were out of a desire to do good and to actually help young people. And so it's not that we don't want to help young people. Nobody would ever be for hurting young people. But it's how you do it and the evidence that you're using to justify what you're doing, right? So again, these policies come into place. I don't think it's necessarily out of a malicious place or anything like that. It's just, in my opinion, perhaps not the right way to go about doing it. But anyway, we'll see what we can do for the Alexanders anyway.
I think the expression from olden days is the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And that might apply here. I do have a question, though, about compelled speech. I just want to go back to that for a second here. And that is the idea of compelled speech being demonstrably justified. I would think that it would be impossible to demonstrably justify compelling somebody to say something. You know, you could probably defend them striking down something if I say I'm indifferent to this group and, you know, oh, well, that's hateful. But I haven't said anything, and now they're going to force you to say something. That, can you think of a case where compelled speech has been upheld by Section 1 being demonstrated? Okay, that's what I was wondering.
No, I can't think of one, and I agree with you that I can't really imagine a circumstance where there would be something so important that it's okay to force you to say something in a given circumstance. I mean, I just can't imagine it.
Neither could I. That's why I was asking.
I mean, some kind of apocalyptic circumstances where, you know, in order for, I'm going to be very silly, but like to distinguish the humans from the aliens, humans can only make a certain type of sound and the aliens can't. And so to pretend that I'm, you know, so that to prove that I'm a human and I can come into the secret base to protect myself from the aliens, I have to say a certain thing. I don't know. But that's ridiculous. I mean, that's totally far-fetched. I just can't think of a legitimate and current situation that would require me to say something.
I suppose just occurred to me, actually, was the whole notion of duty of care. There might be something in there that might compel you to say something, stand up and say something. I'm not sure. But that's another rabbit hole.
But that's not a government thing. Yeah, that's negligence. Like, hey, you know, you have to, you know, be careful. I haven't shoveled the driveway yet or something like that. Yeah. But that's not where the government is asking you to do something. That would just be your obligations as a human, as a person to another person.
Okay.
That would be, not quite the same. So.
Sure. Okay, fair enough. Perhaps we could just finish up with a little update on what's happening in the Zexi Lee Barber versus Barber case.
Yes, absolutely. So the listeners will understand and remember that we are sort of still caught up in the preliminary wranglings of this case. It's now in a situation where we are waiting for an appeal to happen. Essentially, what's going on is the listeners may remember that a few months ago, I commenced a motion in the Superior Court to have all or part of the case dismissed against the defendants because of what we call the anti-SLAPP legislation in the province. Now, that is legislation that is designed to target lawsuits that are basically having a gag rule kind of effect on people. So usually that's a defamation case. So usually the paradigm anti-SLAPP case. And again, just so that we're clear, SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P, is an acronym. And that means Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation, S-L-A-P-P, SLAPP. And what that is basically a lawsuit that is filed for underhanded purposes. It's usually defamation. So usually what happens is somebody says something to somebody else. It's probably not very flattering, but it's probably true. So that person who has been insulted says to the other person, I'm suing you for defamation because what you said to me is defamatory, even though it's not. The listeners will again understand, you can defend a defamation suit by showing that it's true. So I would say, Kevin, if you sued me and you said, hey, James, you defamed me, I would say, yeah, but what I said is true, so it's not defamation. And then you would say, well, I'm suing you anyway. I'm suing you for $200 million or $1 million or whatever it is. And then I would feel very, very fearful of saying anything else, lest I make it worse. So therefore, there's a gag rule basically on me. I'm basically being gagged. And that's because of your strategic lawsuit against me. It's not actually a defamation suit, and we all know that because it's true what I said. It's something that Donald Trump might do, right? Sorry, anybody who supports Mr. Trump. I'm sorry about that. But, it's like getting back at somebody and going nuclear at them for saying something about you that, in fact, may be justified. So there is anti-SLAPP legislation, which means you can target these lawsuits and you can get rid of them if you can show that the lawsuit that you're bringing against me in defamation, for example, relates to a matter of public interest and that it's important, essentially. And then there's other things. If that happens, then if you bring a lawsuit against me, you have to show that your lawsuit has a good chance of success and that I don't have any defenses. And then later on, we have to show, basically, if you can show that your case does have a chance of success and that I don't have any defenses, then we talk about balancing. We talk about balancing my right to freedom of expression is more important than your right to sue me for defamation. And we have to figure out which of those rights is more important in this particular case. Anyway, I don't mean to dwell on those requirements of that test. Essentially, I did that. Okay, so the Zexi Lee plaintiffs in Ottawa have sued the truckers for nuisance. So the anti-SLAPP mechanism doesn't need to be exclusively for defamation. It can be for other types of cases too, so also nuisance. So in this case, what we're saying is that the Zexi Lee plaintiffs, the plaintiffs in the Ottawa case, have brought this action to silence and to gag really the truckers because they can't make it worse. They're going to feel, compelled to stay silent. And anyway, we brought a motion to dismiss part or all of the Ottawa class action on this basis. Sadly, the judge dismissed the motion. He wasn't convinced that this was the case. We have then taken an appeal. So the legislation allows for an appeal. And that means that we have a free opportunity to, and by the way, I say free not because of cost. I say free because usually in the Ontario court system, in a case like this, in the civil cases, in the civil courts, if you lose a motion like this, like a preliminary motion, you don't have an automatic right to appeal it. You have to get permission to appeal it, usually. In this special case, though, the legislature believes that this anti-SLAPP stuff is really important, and they have given a very narrow and express right of appeal just for decisions made about this type of stuff. So it's not common. So when I say free, it's not free in the sense of no money. It's free in the sense of we have an automatic ability to appeal if we think we should. And my assessment of the decision that came from the judge, Justice McLeod, was that there is some argument to be made that Justice McLeod's decision was not correct. There was an error there. That basically he didn't consider the evidence and the arguments appropriately, and he ultimately made a misguided finding that there was no reason to dismiss the case or any part of it. So we're going to be taking that to an appeal, is the long story short. Right now, I have filed on behalf of the truckers the appeal brief. So that's all been done. We're now waiting for the plaintiffs, that's Mr. Champ's clients, to give us their responding brief. And after that, the Court of Appeal in Ontario will schedule a hearing. It'll probably be sometime in, I would think, the summertime or maybe the fall, and we'll proceed there. So even if there was a loss at the Court of Appeal for either side, you could also try to get the Supreme Court to take the case and hear it for a final appeal. That would be rare, but it's possible. So I don't know what's going to happen. We'd have to see what the Court of Appeal's decision comes out with. But technically, there is a possibility that somebody could try to get further leave to appeal to the Supreme Court. So that's what's happening in the anti-SLAPP aspect of this. Remembering as well, Kevin, we have also filed a third-party claim in the truckers' lawsuit against the Ottawa police. Again, there has been evidence and information that's come to light that basically says that, you know, when the convoy was on the way to Ottawa, they were all expecting to park outside of downtown. They were going to park in parkways and other places out of downtown. So if they had parked out of downtown, naturally, the people of downtown Ottawa would not have been, quote unquote, inconvenienced or whatever with the honking and the whatever. So they wouldn't have been there. Like, what I mean is the truckers wouldn't have been there. So that was the plan all along. And then on the last day, before, as they were rolling into Ottawa, the plan changed. And the truckers don't seem to know why the plan changed. But what happened was the Ottawa police began to direct the truckers to simply park their trucks downtown on the city streets. So you park here, you park there, you park here, there, and they would tell them where to park. And of course, the Highway Traffic Act tells us that when a police officer directs you to do something on the highway, you have to comply. That's the law. So they had to park where they were told. So our argument on this third party claim is that to the extent that there's any damages from the truckers being in downtown Ottawa in the form of a nuisance or whatever, those damages should be laid at the feet of Ottawa police because they were the ones who directed the truckers to be there in the first place. And if they hadn't been there, none of it would have happened. So again, some listeners, Kevin, may say, well, how can you blame the Ottawa police for illegal activity that was done by the truckers? I mean, the truckers were honking and that's illegal, and they were violating the noise bylaw. That's illegal. And they were illegally parking in the city street. That's illegal. Different issue. First of all, I don't know which truckers were doing what at what point. That doesn't seem to be clear in this case at this point. But secondly, nobody is trying to suggest that the Ottawa police ought to bear the liability for illegal activity made by anybody. The argument is not that. The argument is if they hadn't put them there, none of this would have happened in the first place. So there is a debate to be had with respect to, you know, what about that? I understand that the Ottawa police did not force anybody to blow a horn. If blowing a horn at the convoy leads to liability, which I don't know that it does, if it does, then it's probably not the Ottawa police's fault that so-and-so blew a horn. But what were they doing there in the first place? That's the Ottawa police's liability. They shouldn't have been there. They weren't supposed to be there. they were planning on not being there. So that's going to be an interesting part of the case. Right now, Kevin, the Ottawa police, they have identified themselves. There's a lawyer who's come out and he has said, hi, I'm the Ottawa police's lawyer and, you know, let's get going. But because of the anti-SLAPP appeal that's happening that I just mentioned, right now the case is technically on hold pending that decision. So that's, again, the legislation says that if you start the anti-SLAPP processes, everything stops in the action until that process is done. So we're still doing it. It's on hold until the decision from the Court of Appeal comes down. So nothing to really be done by the Ottawa police at this point. But once the anti-SLAPP stuff is cleared away, we'll continue. And again, the next big step would be the certification motion. If we get that far, the next step would be to determine whether or not this Ottawa action should be a class action. And there's a whole bunch of principles and stuff that we can talk about later about all that. But that's essentially the next big piece.
Okay. Well, that delay should give us time to look up Chris Barber's testimony at the Public Order Emergency Commission, where he described rolling into Ottawa and being surprised to be directed downtown to park. That was something that was quite memorable, I think, for me anyway.
Right, yeah.
I will thank you for participating and in this episode of Justice with John Carpe, and I really hope we can speak again soon.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. Always a pleasure, and always a pleasure to talk to the listeners. Thanks, guys.